This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to the best of Sounds Like Canada. You're listening to our podcast of the day's highlights of Sounds Like Canada, and you can catch our full show on CBC Radio 1 at 10 o'clock or a couple of times a day on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. Paul Martin left the office of Prime Minister and stepped down as a leader of the Liberal Party of Canada 2 years ago this coming February. He continues to be a member of Parliament for the Montreal riding of La Salle-et-Marne. There are other issues that he's given himself to post-life on Sussex Drive. For instance, he's financing a pilot program in Northern Ontario to help young Aboriginal people complete high school and become interested in business. He's introduced a private members' bill calling on the government to follow through on the agreements made in the so-called Kelowna Accord that it would improve health, education, and housing for Aboriginal people across Canada. He's currently an advisor to the African Development Bank, and he's co-chair of an international fund working to reduce poverty and prevent deforestation in the Congo rainforest basin. And he's still one of the driving forces behind reforming the G8 group of nations to make it more representative of the world's population and power centers. The Right Honourable Paul Martin is seated right across from me. Pinch, I can't believe you're really here. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, and I'm delighted to be here with you this morning.
Quite a list I rhymed off with. I think you're a very busy person right now.
Well, these are the issues that really, in many ways, brought me into public life. It's not unnatural that I would want to continue on with them. It's a different way of doing it. When you're in government, you see the world from 30,000 feet. Now I've got a chance to see the world on the ground, and I must say it's a very different perspective. Makes you rethink a lot of things.
What does it make you rethink?
Well, clearly the issue of poverty is so real when you get beyond the statistics and you see it firsthand. Also, you ask yourself certain questions. Just going through the list that you did, why is it that when I'm in Africa, I see Canadians all over the place working very, very hard and very dedicated, but when you come home to Canada and our own third world, which is the world in which Aboriginal Canadians live, is not one that elicits the same degree of concern. And yet, Canadians are a very generous people, and you ask yourself, why is that?
How did you decide what issues were going to take your attention post the big office?
I didn't decide. They were just the issues that
were bubbling in.
They were just the issues that had concerned me so greatly. I mean, poverty is a fundamental issue. You know, if there is a reason why we are put on Earth, I think one of it is to help other people. That's the issue of poverty. And the other one is, of course, I think to advance human knowledge. Well, I'm not a great scientist, never will be. And so I think that I'm left.
You did
okay
in business.
Yes, I did. I was quite lucky there, but I'm not quite sure. I think that if business properly done, I think that you can deal a great deal with both, but with both advancing human knowledge and poverty. But nobody ever said that I'm going to get the Nobel Prize for science.
How about peace?
Well, it's a huge issue. And it really, obviously, the failure to have peace, which is really historical from the beginning of humankind, but in today's world, it's both great power politics on the one hand, not the great superpower, but it's certainly, I mean, if you look at the question of nuclear proliferation, it's power politics between countries, but it also finds a lot of its root problem in poverty.
I want to ask you about some of the topics that I listed in my introduction. And first of all, because this is something that we're following through our year, we're talking about some of the many issues that are affecting Aboriginal people in Canada today. Last week, we talked about education, as you know, and you've personally financed the pilot project to help young Aboriginal people stay in school and perhaps, hopefully, move on to business. Why is this such a passion in you?
Well, you're not going to deal with the issue of poverty unless among Aboriginals, unless they have the same tools, the same instruments, and the same opportunities. We all understand that in society, that's education. Well, why wouldn't it be the same for them? And it is. I listened to one of your programs last week, and I thought it was a tremendous program where the young people talked about either leaving their homes and then having to go to a strange place for high school, or what it's like to be in a high school where you're doing very well and all of a sudden going to a conventional high school and suddenly finding that you're 2 to 3 years behind. The fact is that the on-reserve grade school and high school system in this country in many ways needs a thorough review and in some areas a complete overhaul. We don't spend the money on reserve educating young members of the First Nation or Aboriginals that we spend in regular high schools. We spend substantially less. That was brought out in your program and I've seen it firsthand. This program that we're doing in Thunder Bay is based on a program that's done in some 14 countries around the world that essentially said young people who are dropping out of school, if you can give them something concrete, they'll stay in school. Well, business is concrete. I can make money. This is where my living is going to come from. So we've taken that program. We're adapting it to the cultural background of Aboriginals, in this case, Cree and Oji-Cree in northwestern Ontario. We've completed our first semester. It's gone very well. We're into our second semester. And as this works out, and we're doing it working very closely with the Ontario government, and as this works out, we want to do it in about 5 or 6 regions of the country and then take it national.
It's still such a daunting thing to try to fix. There's just, I don't know how you don't get stalled by the wall of despair.
Well, first of all, you can't allow yourself to get that way. But the fact is there are so many people out there who are doing so much and are working so hard that, and they're not. And they've been at this a lot longer than I have. But let me just give you another way of looking at it. I'm, as are so many other Canadians, of Irish descent. If you read how the Irish were treated and how they were regarded 200 years ago when they first came to this country, and if radio had been invented and they were talking to somebody and when they said, what about the Irish, they'd have said, well, you know, it's hopeless. It's never going to work. Well, the Irish did tremendously well in this country. There is no doubt in my mind that in the generations to come, people are going to say, look at, I mean, the youngest, the fastest growing segment of our country are Aboriginal Canadians. And somebody is going to say, look how well they are doing. But that's probably a generation ahead.
I think it is a generation ahead. And I think it is because when you talk to young people and you heard Geraldine say, this despair is in our DNA right now. It's going to take a while to get it out of our very systems.
Well, you know, I met with 25 law students at the University of Toronto about 6 months ago. They were all Aboriginal law students. They were as articulate and as bright a group as I'd ever met. And we talked about that. And they felt quite strongly that because they were the first generation post-residential schools and because of the residential school settlement, that there was a real opportunity, that was a major breakthrough and that the residential schools had been for so many years a huge setback. So they felt that in terms of their own identity, their own ability to succeed, their own sense of confidence, that in fact they were the breakthrough generation. I really hope so.
I really hope that's true too. As you say, you go to Africa and you see so many Canadians in Africa and you don't see them dealing with our own third world. Why do you think that is?
Well, I suspect that there are a number of reasons. You know, most Canadians, especially the Canadians who live in eastern Canadian cities, don't meet young Aboriginal kids. I mean, if you live in a western city, it's a different thing. And so perhaps it's not a top of mind issue. I suppose there is a tendency to think, well, and in fact, I've heard it, you know, look, we give them so much money, surely they can do well with it. Well, the problem is, and it came through in your program and I've seen it, in terms of education at least, you know, we're underfunding Aboriginal education. So we really are undercutting them. We're not dealing with people with special needs. And I just don't think that there's that awareness. And I think it is really very important that as we talk about poverty, that we recognize as Canadians that there is a third world here. And I think we also have to recognize something else. And that is when people like myself go to Africa and talk about Canadian values and talk about the necessity of giving people a leg up, that we're not going to be able to maintain that speech if people point at home and say, well, you're preaching abroad, which you're not practicing at home.
I want to ask you about why Canada should be engaged with Africa in a moment. But first, I want to stay with the Aboriginal issue. And one of your legacies as Prime Minister is what's now known as the Kelowna Accord, closing the gap of opportunity between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. But it didn't get passed by Parliament. There was support for the goals that it set out to achieve, but there was a lot of criticism that there was no plan as to how to distribute what would have been the $5 billion that was agreed would be needed to make the changes. So it's now going to move forward, or it's being left to move forward as a private member's bill, your private member's bill. What happened here? Why didn't it go forward? Why couldn't it go forward?
Well, there was a change of government. It's really that simple. The fact of the matter is that every political party supported the Kelowna Accord. Every provincial government did, the territorial governments did, the federal government did, and in fact, the Conservatives did when they were in opposition. They changed their minds once they took office. In terms of the plans, the biggest problem down through history has been the imposition upon Aboriginal Canadians of a unilateral view decided in Ottawa. What Kelowna was 18 months of negotiation, but then what we said is, there's no doubt that if you're a member of the First Nations in British Columbia, you have a different background than if you're a member of a First Nation in Atlantic Canada or Northern Ontario. And so we said, look, we'll do this province by province because, i.e., the delivery of education is going to be done by the province. Each province delivers it in a slightly different way. So the plan was there. The money was set. The objectives were there. The monitoring was there. And in the case of British Columbia, we sat down and signed an agreement as to how it would be spent. But we agreed that that negotiation would be federal government, First Nations band, and provincial government, province by province. So that was all set up. What the denial of the government's word in the case of Kelowna is a statement that we don't think Aboriginals have the right to the same quality of education, the same quality of health care, the same quality of housing, or clean water. And that's just wrong.
They haven't actually said that.
Well, but the fact is, when you deny Kelowna, you basically said the $5 billion that was going to go for healthcare, education, and everybody recognizes, as an example, that in those areas, housing and clean water, that there is a substantial gap between the quality of life, the standard of living in Aboriginals and other Canadians. That money was going to go to work to narrow that gap. Those targets were to narrow the gap. Now, if the government had said, we're not going to do Kelowna, but we are going to fill, we're going to attack the gaps in healthcare and in education, I would have said, well, I think you've missed a great chance on the base of Kelowna, but okay, let's see you do it. That isn't what they did. They walked away from Kelowna, and they also walked away from the plans to deal with those terrible, terrible gaps. So when you have a program like you had last week, when those people are talking about how do you deal with the education system, you know, they're lamenting the fact that the federal government has walked away from the very problems they're identifying.
Paul, there are a lot of Canadians who feel that this would have been throwing good money after bad. What do you say? Lots of money has gone into trying to support programs for Aboriginals.
Well, let's just take a look at education. Federal government does not do anywhere near the job on reserve in terms of education that the provinces do. And the reason is pretty simple. Federal government doesn't have the same experience with education that the provinces do because they deliver it. So what Kelowna said was, we're going to put the money into it, but it is going to be delivered with the provinces and the Aboriginal leadership. So the most knowledgeable people in Canada, the provincial education departments, are going to be working with the Aboriginal leadership. And that was a deal that we struck going into Kelowna so that in fact, the money was going to be better spent than it's ever been. Think about this. This is the first time in the history of the country that there hasn't been a unilateral imposition by the federal government. It's the first time, and this is staggering, in the history of this country, that all levels of government and the Aboriginal leadership came together with a set of objectives. I think that is a significant difference.
I'm speaking with the Right Honourable Paul Martin. He's in our studio in Montreal, and you're listening to Sounds Like Canada on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite Radio 137. Long after leaving the Prime Minister's job, there's still criticism to contend with. Jean Chrétien's memoirs, where he says he felt betrayed. I know you've responded by saying that the two of you recall things differently, but what is it like for you personally to have to revisit the conflicts of the inner sanctum of power politics? through those decades.
I'm not really very interested in doing that. I'm far more interested in the subjects that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, but I have to ask.
No, I understand that you do. And fair game. I guess that what I would really say is that the issues that we're talking about, Canada's role in Africa, the way in which we're basically going to deal with health care and education among Canada's Aboriginals, or other issues such as, you know, child care and early learning, the role of our cities. These are the issues that I feel very strongly about, and I don't think are going to happen unless Stéphane Dion becomes prime minister. I don't think this is a time for Liberals to be dividing. I mean, I look at old battles. Those are old battles. I think what we should really be doing is say, look, this is the kind of country we want, and we're going to be united. And that's my position.
All right. There we go. That's your answer?
There you go.
Okay. Let me go to Africa then, okay? I want to talk to you about this, the things that you are involved in Africa, but again, why Canada should have a high level of engagement with this continent?
Well, for a number of reasons. First of all, Africa is today, unfortunately, the greatest locus of poverty. It is, in many ways, the greatest locus of unfairness. We talk about climate change. The Africans did not contribute to climate change. They're the ones who are going to suffer the most of it. The greatest percentage of people living on a dollar a day. All of the numbers that you understand. But let me give you a different perspective. Africa has population of about 900 million. By the year 2030, it's going to have a population of about a billion and a half. That's going to be equal to China, equal to India. In 2050, it's going to have a population of 2 billion, be 500 million more than China or India. It'll also have the vast percentage of the world's young. Now, you think about this. At that time, with the vast percentage of the young, and a lot of those are going to be young men. Those young men are unemployed. Then you are going to have a cauldron on your hands. Those young people, men and women, have got jobs and are well educated. Then they are going to be a tremendous engine of growth in the country. So essentially, the work that we do in Africa today is going to have a lot to do with the quality of lives that our children are going to have in the years to come.
What moves you so much about Africa?
Oh, you can't go to Africa and not be struck by. I mean, you go to Africa and you walk into a village and you're immediately surrounded by kids, and you go to the local school and you suddenly look out and you think, my God, there are 500 kids here, and there are two school rooms with about four desks, and you say, this is just not fair. You know, I'll tell you, you get the same thing when you go on into many First Nations villages in this country. It's the same thing. It is not fair that young people, and you're talking about the vast majority of Canada's young, the vast majority of the world's young, who for no reason of their own, are suddenly facing such a different life than our children. I had talked across the country about my grandchild, Ethan, and how proud I am. And I look at his chances, and then I look at the chances of these kids, and I say, it's just wrong. And we Canadians understand this. We're a generous people. We have a role and a responsibility. And by the way, this is one area where we don't have to follow any great power, not the United States, not the European Union. The fact is that just as we have to take the lead with Aboriginal Canadians, in Africa, we can take the lead. We have a great history within Africa, going back through the various political parties, not just Liberal. I mean, both political parties, a great history of leadership, and we've got to exercise it.
You've also been pushing for the reform of the G8 and make it into something much bigger, like the L20, Leadership 20. What's wrong with the G8?
Well, it's the same thing that was wrong with the G7 finance ministers when I was a finance minister. At the time of the Asian crisis, as a G7 finance minister, we sat there and we said, no, we've got to tell Indonesia, we've got to tell Brazil, and we've got to tell China to follow rules and regulations which we've set. And they ignored us because they weren't at the table. So we created the G20 finance ministers, which was reflected the world. Well, the G8 today is a group of countries, and Canada is one of them, and enables us to punch above our weight. But does it make any sense to have China and India, Brazil, sitting out in the in the corridor while we're deciding, while we're the caucus that decides where the world is going? No, it doesn't make any sense, and it won't work. It's just simply not representative enough. And if globalization is going to work, if we're going to deal with the problems that you're now talking about in Africa, if you're going to talk about nuclear proliferation, if you're going to talk about climate change, then you'd better have the great powers of the world at the table.
Can it happen?
Yes. And in fact, I believe it's going to happen. When I was a prime minister, I approached all of the G8 countries and all of the so-called G20 countries, and there was overwhelming enthusiasm for it. Now, there were some countries. The United States was less enthusiastic. It is going to happen, absolutely. And we're now seeing President Sarkozy of France the other day called for it. I know the British are on side. I think that there are more countries for it than against it. And I think as time goes on, the absurdity of a small group of countries, excluding China and India, trying to deal with the fate of the world is going to become self-evident.
What about strengthening the United Nations?
Absolutely. But I think that whether it's 20 countries or 15, it's got to be the major countries. I think that they're part of the solution. In fact, the last reform movement of the United Nations, which worked so-so, the panel who recommended the reform said that a group like the L20 should be created because they recognize that you can't have 150 countries around the table. You've got to get the main countries around the table. They've got to do the trade-offs that are required.
I have about a minute and a half before we go to a little break. And I just, because you're here and you were the former finance minister and you've mentioned the G7 finance ministers, this dollar, what if that had been your dollar in 1993 when it was about 78 cents?
Well, actually, there was not a snowball's chance that it would have been. In 1993, we had a massive deficit. We had the highest debt of any country. Our pension plan was in dire difficulty. In fact, we had the worst finances of any of the G7 countries. And that's why our dollar was where it is. The fact is that our dollar is where it is because Canada, unlike most countries, has dealt with its financial condition, and we're generating the kinds of surpluses that we can see.
107.18.
I don't think anybody would have predicted this.
It's breathtaking. Stay with me, will you? After the break, it would be great to have you in with the kids for a little while.
Sure.
All right. I'm speaking with the Right Honourable Paul Martin. You're listening to Sounds Like Canada, coming to you from Montreal. And I'm Sheila Rogers. And in this half hour, we're going to be speaking about reasonable accommodation, but I'm just going to conclude my conversation with the Right Honourable Paul Martin. I do want to ask you about your father. I met your father. I was 11 years old at the Liberal convention that saw Pierre Trudeau become the Liberal leader. I got to shake his hand, and I thought it was very nice that he'd take a minute out of his own conventioneering to speak to a little 11-year-old punk. How much is he a part of your thinking these days as you move out into the world with what you want to do?
Oh, he's been the greatest influence on my life. There's no doubt about it. We were talking about poverty earlier. I mean, that was the driving force in his life. It's the reason he brought in the Canadian healthcare system that we have. And in terms of international affairs, and he was a delegate to the old League of Nations that failed. He was on the first delegation to the United Nations. And we were talking about Africa, Canada's role. He felt that Canada, because of our value system, had a very important role to play internationally. And I don't think it's changed since then. I share that view.
By the way, I wasn't the country's youngest liberal. I just had a crush on Trudeau. That's why I was there.
Well, I, my father was hoping you had a crush on him.
Sorry it didn't work out that way. What about you? You're turning 70 soon. I'm speaking to you in the province that witnessed the Bourassa effect, where Robert Bourassa made a stunning comeback and he reclaimed the Liberal leadership. You've got a lot going on outside of the political sphere. Are you going to run for re-election?
No, I'm not.
You're not?
No. I'm really going to focus on the issues that we were talking about in the first half hour.
Okay. I want to move then on to the issue we're going to talk about in our second half hour, and that's to talk about reasonable accommodation. I'm pleased that Paul Martin will stay for this part of our discussion. Quebec is grappling with some very serious issues right now. Identity, immigration, integration, looking at its past, but also trying to build its future, indeed ensure its future as well. The political scientist Gerard Bouchard and the philosopher Charles Taylor have been touring the province since September, talking to Quebecers about how and if the province should accommodate religious and cultural diversity. The hearings have been, in turn, heated and thoughtful, frustrated and frustrating, hopeful, optimistic, and sometimes just downright angry. Meanwhile, in Quebec City, politicians are debating the merits of the Parti Québécois' so-called Quebec Identity Act, which would deny immigrants Quebec citizenship or the right to run for office if they cannot speak French. Largely absent in these discussions is the voice of young Quebecers. They are, after all, need I say, the future of the province and the country, and they will have to live with the results of the debate. So with me now, I have Jimmy Ng, who studies industrial relations at the Université de Montréal. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
Hello.
And Zoé Gagnon-Paquin is a philosophy student at McGill University and the news editor of the McGill French language newspaper Le Daily. Hi, Zoé.
Hello.
And Arsal Shahabuddin, it works at the pharmaceutical business. He's a member of Helping Islam Live in Montreal. Hello to you, Arsal.
Hello.
And you can all say hello to Paul Martin.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
I don't know if he wants to be called sir. Do you?
No, in fact,
are you going to say that was my dad?
Well, but on the other hand, you having said I'm almost 70, it's axiomatic.
Ah, there you go. Look, we'll start with the front page. The Bouchard-Taylor Commission. We've heard people complain about too much English, about kosher food, about Quebec's so-called secular society, about Islam. And we'll get to more about that in a minute. We've also heard people who say Quebec needs immigrants, needs to be more open and more tolerant. Tolerant is actually a word I personally have great difficulty with myself. But anyway, I want to ask all of you, what do you make over the debate about reasonable accommodation that's going on here in your own home province? Zoé, I'll start with you.
Well, there's two things. There's the debate itself and the central question which underlies it, which is, do religious needs or needs arising out of religious belief constitute rights for people? For example, at McGill, there was a huge debate about whether universities should provide prayer space for the Muslim Student Association. There was a need for them, and the university said it was not something that the university was responsible for. The other thing is the whole perception that Canada has of Quebec resulting from this debate. It is a myth that Quebec is an intolerant society. On the contrary, immigrants here have been accommodated very well, if we compare with France, for example, and we hope to continue in that way.
Okay, Arsal, what do you think? What do you think of the debate as it's happened and played out so far?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, always speaking about an issue is always very important. I think you need to always define an issue and first to proceed. So I think that's important. And people need to have their voices heard. So I think all these things are important, and it's a part of healthy dialogue. But one of the main issues I have with it, though, is that the people who are most affected by this, immigrants, and not just immigrants, I mean, I'm not an immigrant, but I was born and raised in Montreal. I'm in, like, I have, you know, St. Lawrence River water flowing through my blood. But, you know, we're not the ones who get spoken to. It's people speaking on our behalf or speaking about us. And you were speaking before about in Africa, it's people speaking on their behalf. And that's not fair. And I think people need to get to the root of the issue and speak to the people themselves and see what it is that they want.
Okay, Jimmy, you knew it was coming to you next.
Yes, I think it's a good exercise for the society, because I think beyond the debate, it's a reflection also. And the reflection is something a lot more profound. And for society to actually give the opportunity to its citizens from across the provinces, that means whether you're up north or downtown in Montreal, you do get the opportunity to voice your thoughts, your opinion. I think it enables us as a community to get to know each other better. And I think that's the basic in order to have a nice future.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, I guess, first of all, I share your view that I don't like the word tolerant. I think the question is respect. Mm-hmm. I certainly share Zoe's view that Quebec is not, again, to quote, is not intolerant. I think that there is an enormous amount of respect and understanding in this province, nor do I think this is a Quebec-only debate. I think it's perhaps more top of mind because of what's happening with the commission, but I think it's a debate that goes across the country. I don't think you want to hear a lot from me on this because of the young people or people younger than me slightly. But
it's not slight. You've already made that clear.
But I just want to make one point that I think I really believe it's important that Canadians understand their history. And I ask you to go back to the beginning of this country. Two nations at war, France and England. two religions virtually at war, the Catholic religion with the multitude of dissenting or Protestant religions, come together to form a country. I mean, that is extraordinary. And because they did that, and they had to respect each other. And they built a very different nation than any other. And if you take a look at the way immigrants have been treated here and how we've handled immigration, and it wasn't just since the Second World War. You look at the great wave into Western Canada. We have handled it because we have understood each other. And that means that the Canadians who live here have got to be prepared to understand that people are coming here with differences. But people who come here with differences have got to understand that, in fact, after a period of time, there has to be a coming together. And I think that that's the history that we should never forget as the three young people debate their issues.
Zoe, what are you scribbling there?
Paul Martin is mentioning that this is the debate now illustrates just another step in the coming together of different cultures. However, I think similarity is not that great because difference in culture might be even more stark than it was before. And the reason why the commission now is so widely discussed across Quebec is, I believe, because people are slowly realizing that a real change in society is imminent, is going to happen because immigration is increasing and it's something that is not a bad thing. It's the way the world is evolving. And we need to face up to the issue. So it's not a reaction against immigrants, as was sometimes perceived and denounced in the media. It's realizing that the society we're going to build is not going to be perhaps as integrated as it was before because the people are going to be much different. And therefore, they will be living alongside each other, but not maybe with each other as much. And we need to provide guidelines for that.
Jimmy, as you see the hearings rolling out, it's warts and all, really, isn't it? And you said this is a very important thing to air, to open. But how hard is it for you to hear people who sound as though they hate other people. Let's just face it.
I think it's important to keep in mind that some opinions are expressed by a minority of people that are perhaps a little more radical. And it's important
also... They tend to make the news reports, though.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And it's important not to judge a community through its exceptions and to keep in mind that they are exceptions. Now, I think the reason why we are having all these debates is to know how do we manage these exceptions. And I think the general fear of the majority of people is that they're afraid that if we accept these exceptions, that these exceptions will become norms and that people, instead of, you know, seeing them as only exceptions, people are going to take them for granted. And that would change society in a more profound way and where they wouldn't recognize themselves anymore. And I think it's just more a matter of how do we manage these exceptions.
Arsal, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's true. You shouldn't get too caught up and just, you know, like I said, empty vessels make the loudest noise, right? So the one who makes the most noise is necessarily not the right person. But I just want to bring it back to a point that Paul Martin mentioned about it's not necessarily a Quebec thing. It's more a Quebec issue because of the Catholic experience that's happened in Quebec. And CBC organized a conference about 2 or 3 months ago about reasonable accommodation. I don't know if you remember. And in it, one woman came up and said something very telling. There was a panel and there's a rabbi and a priest and a woman wearing hijab. And when the woman got up, middle-aged woman, she said that, I know that you're just a person like me and I have no issues with it there, but because of my background experiences, right, and the way the church sort of dictated their life, she said, I know it's just a piece of cloth and to you it means more, but I have trouble overcoming that. Mm. So I think a lot of the history, like you mentioned, that's coming into the play here. So it's more of a Quebec issue than it is other places because of that, of the baggage and the things that people have gone through, for right or wrong, that they've gone through, and they have trouble accepting it from other people because of that.
Do you think it is the piece of cloth or as the outward representation of what that religious belief is, or is it the religious belief? What do you think, Zoe?
The reaction varies widely whether we are in the regions or in Montreal. I come from a very homogeneous city, Quebec City, and I'm now studying in a very multicultural university. And I studied with a lot of girls wearing hijab, and it's not hard to get used to. I understand, however, that people from the regions receive more strongly this sign because they don't know what is behind. It's the unknown, and the unknown is always frightful, especially because most Muslims have a very strong sense of identity because they, of course, have a very they have a religious belief, and that faith gives them a very strong sense of identity. And I don't think we can say as Quebecers that we have that strong sense of identity today.
Mm. Arsal, how does it make you feel that people are expressing fear for your faith, for Islam?
I find it interesting because one of the things is that personal experience breaks down barriers. And a lot of times people who are speaking up so vehemently against immigrants, Muslims, whatever you want to call them, they're people who haven't lived with them or even met them. So you have somebody who've never probably met an immigrant saying this is their biggest issue. But you see, when people meet people, then you realize like, there's a person like me saying hopes and fears. They have different beliefs and they stand by that. But ultimately, there are a lot of similarities. And I think when you don't have that personal experience, people forget that. And people get caught up in abstractions versus, what the reality is. The reality is that we're all people and we need to work together. And there are some differences, absolutely, but we can work it out. And just one example I want to give is that about a month ago, there was a hockey player, I think in Sherbrooke. He was a Jewish man and, a teenager. And he was quite a good hockey player, and he had a good career, and he was missing some games on the Sabbath. So the team said, well, you can't do this. You have to choose. So they sat down together, the family and the player and the team, and they came to a reasonable solution, right? They didn't need laws. They didn't need something from above. They thought about it reasonably, and they came up with a solution they're both happy with. I think it's really as simple as that.
Paul?
I think that you've challenged me somewhat, and you say that you think the debate is different in Quebec than it is in the rest of the country. And I guess I just ask you, do you think the debate is different? And I'm not sure I agree with you, but do you think the debate is different, let's say, in Montreal than it would be in Toronto or Calgary or Vancouver?
No, I think the difference is mainly between homogeneous populations and multicultural populations. And unfortunately, this debate here going on in Quebec has the power to finally unite more the gap that is unfortunately actual between Montreal and the regions. However, I think a lot of the coverage of the issue wants to show that this gap is widening, and that's very unfortunate.
Mm. I am very interested in the difference between Montreal and the regions, but I'm also wondering if anyone else has a comment about how you think this might fit in the rest of the country and whether it would be different. Can you hazard a...
Think that there is a difference between the debate here in Quebec and the debate we could have elsewhere in Canada because of the history in Quebec. The fact that French community is a little more important in terms of numbers. And so that changes the facts in terms of the cultural background. And so if you're looking at it from a different point of view, from a more French point of view, I think there could be differences from if you did it in the rest of Canada where most immigrants will speak English, while here you have immigrants that speak French and immigrants that speak English and that don't speak the other language. And so there's like these, it kind of unburies some of the old debates at the same time because like what kind of, do we prefer French immigrants, French-speaking immigrants, or English-speaking immigrants? So that's another issue as well.
Yeah, I think there is a difference. And one of the things, it's part of the French experience, which makes Montreal specifically so unique, Quebec in general. Montreal is a unique city from other cities in Canada. I've traveled across Canada. And Montreal is different. Look at the license plate, Je me souviens. What are they remembering, right? It's ingrained, and people don't realize they see this every day. You walk by a car, it's ingrained in their history, and they're very proud of what they've done to keep the culture the way it is, and it's very different from the rest of Canada because of that. So that's good. But what's happened is that they've forgotten the things that the French society in general has had to fight for, and rightfully so, to keep their culture. They're now doing the same thing to other people and not allowing them to express themselves and to find that balance. They're afraid. And I think they're not remembering that what they had to deal with. So I think a lot of that has to do with that.
So you were, of course, I can see you. I'm usually in Vancouver, but there you are writing something down. What did you write down this time?
It was to answer Jimmy, who was placing French at the heart of the debate in reasonable accommodations. I don't think that's the heart of the debate. The heart of the debate is really about religious rights and how they have a place in secular society.
Although he did cite that as a difference between, yes, say, Montreal and Quebec and then the rest of,
yes,
Canada.
Well, this debate around French is something that's very important in Quebec, but it is not to be confused or assimilated or ingrained within the reasonable accommodation debate, which is already as enough complicated as it is. Mm-hmm. It is important that Quebec finds a reasonable way to protect its French and respect people at the same time. That's also very difficult.
The other big topic is the PQ's Quebec Identity Act, which, if passed, would restrict who could become a full and active participant in political society. Jimmy, you were born here, comfortable, mm-hmm, in English and in French. You're a Quebecer, but there are those who might not say you're Quebecois and never will be because of your background.
Yes, indeed. Actually, my parents were born in Cambodia from parents that were born in China. So, of course, growing up, there's a...
I want a big chorus of "We Are the World" here.
I'm part of what they call visible minorities. So, yes, indeed, I think that it is that project in itself. I think it's very doubtable in the sense that. I don't see how in a society that is democratic you could actually... I don't see how that can promote social cohesion when you display yourself through a project like that. But anyhow.
Paul?
Oh, I think that that PQ piece of legislation has been largely...
You sure you wanted to say legislation there?
Well, no, attempted legislation has been largely rejected. And I think that... I think that shows the maturity of Quebec society in rejecting it. It's also the reason, however, that I agree with Zoe. Look, there's no doubt that the protection of the French language is an important part of Quebec. But I think Zoe's absolutely right. When you look at the debate of reasonable accommodation, don't take that too far. And I think that the example of not taking too far is the fact that most Quebecers of the Francophone Quebecers that I know have rejected that piece of legislation for the very reason that Jimmy gave.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think? What do you think about this particular piece of not quite legislation?
Well, one, it's against the Constitution, so it's sort of a moot point. But aside from that, like I said, most people here have already said that. The people have spoken and people don't find it's a fair thing to do and people reject it, and rightfully so. I think people, like you said, they have enough maturity to realize that it's not fair and excludes people. And people have, if they want to stand for office and they're capable to do so, then that's the most important thing.
Zoe?
It's a very problematic bill. I believe that it was presented not with the hope that it would pass, but with the hope to gain political capital. Mm. But however, I'm really happy that this would happen at the same time as the reasonable accommodation hearings, because it shows just how much the question of the Quebec identity is relevant to that debate. I think that the Quebecers are extremely sensitive to the question.
You can't leave without saying goodbye. I'm sorry.
Oh, goodbye, Paul Martin.
Well, look, I've got it. I am.
I know you have to go.
I have to go. Well, let me just say that. Thank you for including me in this second round. And I've got to say that the whole debate of reasonable accommodation will succeed if, in fact, it's out and in the public and Canadians discuss it. Mm. And I've got to say that having the three young people here.
Four
young people. That's right. No. Having the five young people around the table, I think, has been really worthwhile. And I let me congratulate you for that, Sheila.
Well, thank you. It's been a great pleasure to have the Right Honourable Paul Martin with us. Not every day you get to have a former Prime Minister in a discussion like this. All the best. And he's going out the door. I have to do a little radio play-by-play, make up for the sound effects. Zoe, what you were saying is very interesting to me. And I want to know how Quebecois or Quebecoise you feel.
Oh, I feel completely Quebecois. There is no doubt about that. I was born in Ottawa, and that's a funny part of the story. But I've always resided here, mm-hmm. And I don't have the choice. I don't have any other roots or any other identity.
You mean you don't have the water of the St. Lawrence flowing through your veins like Arsal does?
Oh, I mean, I do. That's
now. But you weren't born here, though.
Oh no, I'm probably more Quebecois than people who were born in Quebec City.
Arsal, what about you? Do you think of yourself as Quebecois?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm part of the society. I was born here. This place has been very good to me, absolutely. The city, the country, absolutely. And, you know, I want to give something back to it. Born and raised here, you can't forget that. And one telling story is that I was talking with a colleague one time at work, we were just chatting, and, you know, I was saying something like, I play hockey too, and it's in Montreal, right? So hockey, that's the big thing to do. And he's like, oh, you guys play hockey too? He couldn't make the distinction, like a Muslim person would play hockey. But then, you know, that just, it, once you break down those barriers, and then, you know, your friends and, you know, life goes on, everybody's happy. It just, you know, it takes that initial little push, I think, to make people realize we all are Quebecers, and we, you know, we do need to work together, as cheesy as it may sound.
Jimmy, it doesn't sound cheesy, mm-hmm. but it's kind of a nice notion.
Well,
how about you?
I also feel really Quebecois, but I do find fascinating the way that identity is more and more relative, I find, in the sense that if I'm traveling in the world, in some countries I would identify myself more as a Canadian, but inside Canada I identify myself as a Quebecois, and, mm-hmm. and within Quebec I identify myself as a Lavalois, for example.
Oh, no, it just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. Do you talk about politics a lot amongst your peers at family reunions, Zoe, for example?
No, and the reason for that is that I have family from Hérouville, and it therefore is a very delicate topic.
This is the place where really the debate began because of the motions of the council there saying, yeah. So it's delicate. And how delicate is delicate?
Not very. It's something that people have not been used in the regions to discuss multiculturalism because it's not a reality there. And there might be reasons why Hérouville was the first to face up to that new reality. I don't know them. But it's a very... It's the way we're going to have to do things now, to start talking about it. And it's unfortunate that the first acknowledgement of that reality should have been perceived as intolerant. Perhaps it was. But at least it was acknowledging the new reality.
And it was out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Arsal?
I just want to read one thing. It's actually from Alberto Manguel, who wrote this City of Words and doing the Albert Massey lectures.
Yeah.
He quotes...
you get big CBC points for that.
Do I? Yeah. I'm glad. I'm on my t-shirt in the mail. So he quotes the philosopher Strabo, who's also a geographer. They're talking about ancient Greece, the time of Alexander. Let me read this quickly. He says, the author rejects the notion of a twofold division of the human race between Greeks and barbarians, and disproves of the advice given to Alexander that he treat all Greeks as friends and all barbarians as enemies. It is better, he writes, to employ as a division criteria the qualities of virtue and dishonesty. Many Greeks are dishonest, and many barbarians enjoy a refined civilization, such as the people of India, or the Aryans, or the Romans, or the Carthaginians, or Virginians.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if people can figure this out 2,000 years ago, you know, people are different. That's nothing wrong with that. No one's better, no one's worse, based upon where you're born and what language you speak. It's regardless of that. It's rather what you do. And you only realize what you do when you live together and when you open, you know, your hearts and minds to each other and you learn from each other. And I think the heart of the debate is really that simple. It's a matter of attitude on both sides. The people who are asking for certain things, they need to be flexible. And the people who are the vast majority need to be flexible as well.
Jimmy.
Absolutely. I agree with Esther. And, politics, I think, is an important subject that isn't discussed enough today. I think there's a lot of cynicism in society, especially amongst the youth. And I think it's a problem that isn't just specific to Quebec. So I think there's a crisis over there as well. But otherwise, to come back to reasonable accommodation, I think that there's a distinction that should be made sometimes between immigrants that have recently arrived and cultural minorities, for example, mm-hmm. immigrants that are citizens. And I think that we have a tendency to put them in the same group, while in reality, there's a difference between the two. And I think that in general, we have to be more accommodating towards the ones that just got here than from the people who have been here for a little longer.
Will you three come and talk to me again as the hearings proceed?
Yes, I would love to.
Okay, that would be
great. If I get my free T-shirt off.
Okay, I'll bribe you with a T-shirt. Believe me, when you see it, you'll wonder why you wanted one. But anyway, thank you so much. Arsal Shahabuddin, say it for me.
Shahabuddin.
Shahabuddin is a member of Helping Islam Live in Montreal. Zoe Gagnon-Pequin is a philosophy student at McGill University, and Jimmy Ng is studying industrial relations at Université de Montréal. And the Right Honorable Paul Martin is a former Prime Minister of Canada. I'm Sheila Rogers, the host of Sounds Like Canada, and we... That's the best of Sounds Like Canada. Highlights from our show on CBC Radio 1, heard weekday mornings at 10 o'clock. I'm Sheila Rogers. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.